You're listening to the Laugh Factory Podcast Network. For more shows, visit the podcast page at laughfactory.com.
It's the After Laugh, After Laugh. Welcome to the After Laugh, After Laugh, After Laugh. After Laugh, man.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the After Laugh. It has been a while. It's been a couple months. I had an interview with my ex semi-fiance, and then I felt like I jumped the shark on the podcast after that interview, I guess. I don't know what happened. Anyway, I'm here with Ashwin Jacob, who is a new friend I just met. We did a show together last night in a bar.
In Beverly Hills.
This is part of the game. People don't realize that as comics, you always do comedy clubs, but sometimes you do really weird venues. And last night was a pretty weird venue because it was a very fancy hotel lobby bar, right?
That was a lobby bar. Weirdest one I've done this month.
Really?
I've done an underground Koreatown casino. I've done a laundromat.
Underground casino?
Underground casino,
like,
man.
Like the movie Rounders and John Malkovich and
yeah,
Russian mobsters.
Yeah, just in the back of like a Korean barbecue spot.
Do you mean underground like the underworld underground? You just mean it was in the basement?
It's in like the basement, and there's like a full out casino in Koreatown.
Are they not allowed to have a casino?
They're not allowed to have a casino. Oh, so no
it is,
license.
It is underground.
It's definitely a Boston.
What
movie.
Are they doing blackjack or what are they playing?
Blackjack, mahjong, table games, craps.
Do you feel like it's all mafia, like the Korean mob?
I won't confirm or deny, but you know they did pay me, so I'm happy about that.
Cash, obviously.
Cash. Yeah. And all you can eat Korean barbecue.
That's a pretty good deal.
You know, that's not a bad deal.
Yeah. There's a lot of weird things happen in this business that you go from zero to hero very quickly. Like, I've had some ups and downs to say.
Yeah.
But sometimes the weirdest things, like someone said, hey, you want to come down to Newport Beach and do this hotel? We'll give you a room and we'll give you a food expense and we'll pay you on top of it and a drink expense. So I go down there. It's like it's this 5-star hotel. I have a corner suite with 2 balconies, like 2 bathrooms, 2 TVs. There's a jacuzzi by a fireplace. I mean, it's insane. It's like an $800 a night room, right? And everyone there in Newport Beach is super fucking rich and super, super Republican. And they're just like offering you money and tips. And so it ends up being this little gig that was like, oh, fuck it, I got a Newport Beach that ends up make almost $1,000 by the end, you know, when all said and done. So it's weird that way. I don't know. A lot of people think it's just comedy clubs and theaters, but there's a lot of weird little gigs that come up. What's your weirdest gig you've ever had?
Weirdest gig I've ever had was a laundromat show.
That's actually a kind of cool idea. I kind of like that idea.
Laundromats are fun, man. You got to try and make people laugh in between the spin aisle.
How long ago was this?
This was like 4 years ago.
Did you create a lot of laundry material?
I had a great set of laundry material. I did my own wash in between the set.
Did you really?
I talked to people about
for
what stains they had.
You got a free wash of laundry?
Free wash and
That's
dry,
what they pay
man.
You?
Free wash and dry.
Yeah. Oh my God, was it an Asian company? Who are the people running it? I just don't know any non-Asians who run laundromats in LA.
I have no idea. There wasn't anybody that spoke English in the laundromat.
Yeah.
There was a comic that
How many
me.
People, so the people that were watching were just people who were there washing their clothes?
Just washing their clothes for the
so
most part.
So you didn't have chairs set up and you had like...
Just laundromat chairs, you know, people waiting, some people on their iPhones. It was a gladiator sport that night.
Oh my God. I don't know if that's amazing. Adam Hunter used to do a show called Kamikaze Comedy, where he would just, in the middle of wherever the fuck it was, he would just portable microphone with the boombox and just start doing jokes. And it would be like in front of abortion clinics, at a funeral. I mean, whatever the craziest thing you can think of, where you're just like, hey, let's do Kamikaze Cosby in the library, whatever the fuck it was. But it has that kind of... That kind of vibe when you're doing a laundromat, right?
That one was hilarious. A laundromat felt like I was Russell Crowe in Gladiator. Are you not entertained?
I hope that was recorded. That's something you want to have
I
for
wish,
posterity.
Dude. I wish I had recorded that.
Yeah, yeah. There's, I will also say this. There's also shows, as much as you've done, as much as I've done theaters, I haven't done stadiums, but as much as I've done theaters and clubs and probably most of the clubs, big clubs in America at this point, it does, I will still end up finding myself on shows where I'm like, how the fuck did I get it? But I think it's good. I think it's good to tell yourself that that's part of the fun.
It's a blast, especially when you end up in shows that it's just horrible. Everything's bad about it.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that you learn the best stuff as a comic. Because if you can get those people to laugh, dude,
absolutely,
you've got a great skill set there.
Absolutely.
You know, it's hitting audiences that you don't necessarily resonate with because you never know, dude. You could do a show at the Laugh Factory or the Comedy Store and the audience just isn't your particular style. And you either got to adapt or you can just say the audience sucks. And ultimately, that's on you because you're the one that's trying to make people laugh. That's your job.
Agree. I don't believe in the theory that the audience, oh, this audience sucks. When you hear comics, oh, the audience, oh, yeah, they sucked. I'm like, you guys just aren't, you're not on the fly working the way you should be, because or you're not good at it yet, or you'll never be good at it,
or you're just committed to the set.
I think I'm I think I'm okay with that. But then you see someone like Godfrey, who, I mean, the fact that this guy isn't in the conversation for one of the best out there, you watch him and he will take a room where everybody's bombing and he'll figure it out. Like, it's, he'll have a code. He'll figure out the cheat code for the audience. I've never seen him not do it. I've seen him lose his shit and get, like, mad at people when I probably think he shouldn't. But if he wants to do the... I did one for Planned Parenthood, a fundraiser, or it's for, like, a shelter, women's shelter. And, like, they don't want to laugh. They don't want to laugh at men up there talking about men shit. You gotta be really careful. And he went up there. Everyone was eating. And I'm talking about great comics bombing. And he went up there, and I don't know what he does, but he figures out a way to win him. You know, maybe it's just because he has so much fun doing it. I don't know, when people can't help but get, like, sort of conflated into his laughter. But it's, I don't know. I agree what you said, though. I just don't think that there is such thing as a bad audience. So you have a comic, haven't figured them out yet.
It's also figuring out the room, too. Sometimes the audio in the room travels a little bit wonky, and it's just being adaptive. You know, you really have to adapt to that audience, because ultimately, those are the people that are providing your bills and allowing you to do the craft that you love. So you got to figure out how to hit them.
Last night, for example, Ella, I was kind of going to material, and then I realized that once I started talking to them, it opened up way better. Or talking about other people, or just like, you girls look stupid. You don't know what I'm talking about. Or whatever it is. Similar things like that, that all of a sudden the audience feels, oh, we're part of a show that's unique, as opposed to a comic on stage and hit play and just started doing their material. You know?
That's sometimes the worst. You just watch somebody and you're like, I've seen this set 3 times. It's not clicking right now. And you're just sticking to the same exact.
Oh, it's the worst when you start a bit. It doesn't happen to me that long, but it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
Where you start a bit and you're totally in your head. And you kind of segue into a bit that you weren't sure, and then you start doing the bit, and it's a long bit. Let's say it's like let's say my accent bit, which is like a 3-minute bit I do.
Okay.
Usually I have a lot of fun with it, because I do all these different accents, and I get to be physical. I get out energy. Sometimes it's a long fucking bit and a lot of commitment, and I'm starting like, I don't want to do this fucking bit. And they're also just not into me. And I'm like, I'm going to fucking expel so much energy and hump imaginary air for this joke, and they hate me. And then he's just like, how do I fucking pull the ripcord on this joke? But I think as a comic, that's part of the thing. You got to figure, any long bit, you got to have a ripcord. You have a way out. You have an off ramp. Just figure it out, you know? Just
exit.
Yeah.
Click eject. But sometimes you might make like an amazing friend at a comedy show.
Yeah.
Somebody that loves you after your set.
Yeah.
And they become your biggest supporter. I made friends with a Russian mobster at a show that I did at the Improv a while ago. Became my best friend. I had a joke about how I was in the friend zone with a girl, but her kind of ex-boyfriend sent me a message in my other inbox and was like, I know what you're doing with my girl. I'm like, I was high on shrooms. So I'm over there being like, what am I doing with your girl? He's like, I saw you on a Ferris wheel with her the other night. And I was like, I was on a Ferris wheel with her the other night. He's like, this is totally disrespectful. And like, I'm going to come and like beat the shit out of you. And I'm like, listen, I'm going to tell you something about your girlfriend that you probably don't want to hear. She's my good friend. but she's really hard to schedule with. So she's probably cheating on you with somebody else. So we have a shared enemy.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been committed to this for 3 years.
Yeah.
You've been at it for a year. There's a third guy in the picture, because if you're not seeing her and I'm not seeing her, we got a mutual enemy.
Oh, wow.
This Russian guy comes up to me after the set. He's like, this guy threatens you. You know, what do we do? You know, you give me his number. I find him next Sunday. You play soccer ball with his head. And I was like, I'm bad with blood. If I was good with blood, I would have been a doctor.
Yeah,
like the rest of the Indian people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't take care of this guy.
He didn't take care. I mean, it was for me. I didn't want to play soccer ball.
When he told the guy, hey, this girl is with other people, what did he say?
He just got defensive about it. You know, it really hurt his ego.
So you were hooking up with this girl for 3 years, and he'd been hooking up with her a year.
Yeah.
This girl didn't fucking care. How'd he find out that you were she was fucking you? Oh, because
he just saw her post me on Instagram. But I'm like, girls sometimes
do that. Why would she post you on Instagram unless she deliberately wanted?
They want to make people jealous.
Yeah,
that's what some of these girls are doing. I'm like, I'm just your friend.
Yeah,
this just happens occasionally, once in a blue moon. I don't know why it happens.
That's a good friend.
Yeah, you know, that's a friend that cares about you.
God, I wish I had friends like that.
You know?
Yeah.
It happens. You know, I came out here originally with Playboy magazine when I was 19 years old.
Okay, go back to that. Oh, yeah, let's get to your origin story. So you were obviously, you're Indian. Both parents Indian.
Yep.
Born where?
My parents were both born in India. My dad was in Nigeria. And then I grew up in Framingham, Massachusetts. So I have a wicked piss of Boston accent. That's how I used to talk.
Yeah. Framingham, is that part of the fucking trashy pot? Is it?
Oh, it's definitely a trashy pot of Boston.
It's not like fucking Newton, fucking Waterbury.
Former military barracks. That's what I grew up in.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Your dad was military?
No, low income housing. Immigrants moved here with nothing, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Indians are an industrious minority group. We come over here with Warby Parker glasses, a backpack, and we took over Google.
They are. It's a it's such a delicate subject that people never want to talk about because of just sort of immigrant stories, like why some immigrants do really well and some immigrants don't do as well, and some immigrants and some people who are native to America are in a culture that is just cycling into more and more poverty and violence and stuff like that. And there's so many, like, I mean, you can only throw the white supremacy, you know, thing around too much before we realize, like, hey, Nigerian Americans are some of the most upwardly mobile groups in the country right now.
Massively.
They're killing the fucking game. So it's not just people looking up, hey, is that a black person? It's not just that. But people don't want to address the fact that there are cultural variables in any situation. They just don't want to do it. They don't do it. But Indians have Indians are part of Asia, but a very strict, it's just part of the culture. It's like strict parents across the board. I've rarely met an Indian who had parents who were like stoners, like, man, whatever. You can choose your gender. It's cool.
No, we have ultimate standards for excellence. Like, I was excited. I booked my first billboard in Times Square. I brought it up during my set last night. And I was like, I'm going to bring my mom and dad to New York City to see my face in Times Square.
Yeah.
My face is on the NASDAQ building. Huge building.
Huge.
Pretty prestigious. And I'm like, this is cool. Yeah. For me, this is awesome. I booked a credit card ad. Didn't make the best money, but my face is in Times Square.
Huge.
I'm like, I made it. You know, my face is in Times Square. This is like a new legacy mark for me.
Yeah.
And my mom looks around and she says, you know, there are two billboards that are bigger than yours. Maybe next time you can end up on one of those.
Was she trying to be funny when she said that? That is
excellence,
crazy.
Man. We strive to be number one.
But usually I feel like it's the dad that's more of those billboards not good enough.
Not good enough.
It's your mom.
Yeah, it was my mom.
Wow. That's crazy.
It is super
But it's
funny.
Also great.
It's amazing material.
Amazing material. And also, like, it gives people drive.
100%.
I think every parent, you know, you always have to figure out the line between pushing your kid and loving your kid. And sometimes you think pushing them is loving them. But it's not. It's just pushing them because you're fucking ego. And sometimes you just loving them is coddling them, which makes them weak and fucking, you know, a mess like this generation is right now. I feel like such an old fuddy-duddy. It's like these kids.
But honestly, dude, I'm young and I feel like too many people blame everything on their circumstances or like, I just don't have an opportunity. You can watch. I watched a Bill Burr clip the other week, and he's like, you know, when I left Boston, I came out here, and I stood in line from 9 a.m. getting a sunburn. And I could picture Bill Burr outside getting a sunburn, being irritated, and doing his audition set at the Laugh Factory. There's no hacks in life for the most part.
Yeah.
You got to be willing to do the ugly shit.
Fucking crow for a while.
Then there's
a certain point where you're like, you can, I think what you get like in your 40s and 50s, you can start being like, okay, I'm not going to do that. But until then, but even then, I think people let their ego really affect them in ways that are just counterproductive. You should pretty much always go, if it's what you want to do and it's your passion, you do things for either love or money. And if it's either of them, just fucking do it and shut the fuck up. I can't believe, like, you know, producing comedy shows and booking comics. And I like comics in general. I think they're nice people and they're damaged little birds. But you're a fucking comic. Relax. You're not curing cancer. You're not inventing anything that's going to change society. You're telling variations of poop, fart, dick, relationship jokes. No one, quit taking yourself so fucking seriously. What we need, I need a poster. I need a flyer. Blah, 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 blah. If we can advance and blah, blah, blah. My reputation. Shut up. Shut up. Shut up, dude. Shut up. You're doing a show. You're doing a showcase show at the third best comedy club in LA. Calm down. You know what I mean?
Just text a couple of friends. I actually, I did something because I was like, I want to create a culture of like trying to help people. Because like in comedy, so many people are like, I was abused. So I want to be abusive to the next person. I want to keep things
secret.
That's
so crazy, yeah.
My view on life is, if I'm up for a role, odds are my demographic is not going to hit necessarily your demographic 100%.
Yeah.
If I put you on an opportunity, it helps myself in a very selfish way, because the more people I put on to opportunities, eventually some of these people will give me another opportunity at something.
Yes.
So I did the post and I was like, hey, I have some of these shows I'm helping produce. I can put some comics that are developmental that haven't been getting booked, as long as you help promote a little bit. There's no ticket minimum, yeah, but I want you to do some posts, text a couple of friends. Hella comics I've never seen perform on any show or no, in any club messaged me and said, well, the only way I would post is if it was at the Laugh Factory or the Comedy Store. And I'm like, you have 1,000 followers, buddy. Like, I'm not asking you to post this 10 times a day, oh, but like, God, once every other day for a week, maybe text 4 friends.
Yeah.
Bring your mom, bring your uncle, bring 100%. A coworker.
Yeah. That's
wild. Give them a free ticket. I said free tickets too. I was like, just bring somebody.
Bring somebody, yeah. Get the drink quota up.
You know?
Yeah, people feel very, I don't know if it's a generational thing or not, how entitled people feel. I remember when I started doing comedy, and we'll get to your origin story in a bit. But bringer shows were the way I started, you know? I did a couple open mics, but then, you know, to have a real show where you'd have Jim Gaffigan or Seinfeld or people at Gotham Comedy in New York come by, you'd have to be a bringer show and basically be a person a minute. So you bring 10 people, you get 10 minutes. And I could do that kind of in my 20s, late 20s,
yeah,
when I started. But after a while, like, you're going to run out of fucking people.
You're going to burn your friend group.
You're going to burn your friend group, particularly when you're a new comic. Like, how much fucking material do you have?
Yeah.
How much good material do you have? You think you can go up there and riff, and you kind of can't. But yeah, so I think that's how did, now, when you came up, you were, let's go back to, when did you get started in comedy?
Dude, so I was doing comedy secretly in Boston. I was a talent manager at that point in my life.
Were you working with anyone in Boston as a talent manager?
Dude, I was, so basically what happened was I got hired by Playboy. I did.
How
did
you hire by Playboy at a young age? How old were you?
I was 19 at that point.
19. You just, you sent some dick pics or like, we like this kid?
No, dude. I was in Florence, Italy. I was doing a study abroad program. I had no money in Florence, so I had to get a job. And then this guy was like, hey, do you think you can bring girls to our nightclub?
Hey, can you bring girls to a nightclub, please?
So I had a wicked thick Boston accent growing up. So like, I would just do whatever line they wanted from a Boston movie. Like, hey, do you like apples? I got a number. How do you like them apples?
Yeah, yeah.
Just anything from the Departed. And then people would stop and talk to me. And I'd get these groups of girls to come to the club. And I'd pull up to the club every night with 20, 30, one night 75 girls, and there's a guy that worked for Playboy that was in Florence. He's like, every time I see you, you're with a ton of girls. Mind you, I'm just walking them. I'm guiding them with a map. I pre-walk this exact destination so I don't look dumb in front of the girls.
Yeah.
And then I get a couple of free drink tickets and I give them all free shots when they walk into the club. So I ran with that, and he's like, I work for Playboy. And I was like, hey, if you ever need somebody to assist you with anything, I'd love to do that. And that was my first trip out to California. I came out.
So you were in Italy doing this, and he just saw you there.
Promoter.
So you went back to L.A., and then he called you from L.A. He's like, hey, we want to hire you to come out here. How did that work?
Basically that. It was like, hey,
and they flew you out like first class?
No, dude, I flew myself out.
Okay.
And then I came out to LA, stayed in a hotel. But like, he met me basically doing what comics in New York do in Times Square, which is basically barking.
Uh-huh.
I was a street nightclub promoter. I had flyers. I was on the street, the lowest level of like a nightclub promoter. But I found these weird deals with like these fashion houses that they'd have me bring in girls, then gift them clothes and stuff. So I looked like I was a wealthy guy because I got nice free clothes from these Italian designers.
Sunglasses at night.
Yeah, man. Like I was living like a teenage fuckboy dream. Came out to LA with Playboy. And I was answering phone calls, and his playmates being like, oh, you sound really nice. Thank you for answering my question. I'm going to be in a short schoolgirl skirt with glasses. How do I find you? And I'm like, I'm the Indian guy, shaved up head, big gold chain.
So when you flew to LA and you had the meeting with a guy, what was the offer of the job?
Dude, originally I was like trying to get people to buy tickets to go to the Playboy Mansion.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Buy ticket. How much was a ticket to the Playboy? I thought that was just invite only, no tickets.
There were tickets. There were parties that were invite only, but Max, who produced the show, he produced these tickets that were like VIP experiences where you go to the Playboy Mansion.
So right, Max is working with Playboy.
Max was working with Playboy.
So how long have you known Max? So we did a show last night. The promoter producer is this guy, Max. Now, I love this guy. I don't know him that well.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that he has a beautiful wife.
And former playmate.
Former playmate. And I know they like to party. And by party, I mean LA party, which the people know in order to. He likes, but it's just so funny because last night, you know, I did the show. And I probably got off earlier. I don't know how much you want me to do, but I was like, fuck, I'm getting off. And he came up to me and said, hey, man, did you get your valet? He was kind of like standing real close to me and his finger just kind of hit my finger. I'm like, what is he? And he was sliding me money. But he was doing it in this like, hey, man, you make sure your car's in like, you know, looking around the room. I'm like, I didn't just buy Coke from you, dude. Why are you just hand me the fucking money? Maybe he didn't want to see other comics that he was handing. I don't know if I can know, but he like handed me cash last night. Like we were in Vegas doing some sort of shady deal. Anyway, so Max used to work. So you've known him for what? How many years?
Dude, I've known him since 2007.
Holy fucking shit. That's like 17 years?
No, yeah, that's close to that, bro. I think it's like just under 20 years.
Oh my God, that's fucking bananas. So he must have been a very different guy back then, huh?
Very different guy.
Yeah.
He's a young buck. So if you see him going hard now, just amplify that by 10x.
Oh my God, yeah. He probably just full of piss and vinegar and just, I can imagine.
Living his best life, dude.
Yeah.
He's the guy with the keys to the Playboy Mansion.
Whoa, I didn't know that about him.
And his song on his website used to be like a song that was like, please, Mr. Hefner, let me throw a party at your mansion.
So he was the guy coordinating everything or just the paid customers to the
everything,
mansion?
Dude. The Playboy models, the entertainment, the bookings, the celebrity guests.
Man, that's fucking banana. So he was right-hand man.
It was like the heyday of Playboy. He produced a lot of like different parties with them.
I got to interview him. What the fuck are you doing here? I got to get him on the fucking...
Max has a great story, dude.
Yeah.
So I knew
this. When you see his wife, you're like, this guy's... Something's going on with this guy. And I know comedy for him is sort of his fifth business side venture. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Isn't his main thing. He was like, oh, let's do a comedy show.
He started doing it. I was like, hey, Max, I'm down to like help you start producing some of these shows. So I've like recently started helping him with figuring out how to do some of these shows. Because, dude, a big part of the hustle that we're in is if you have your own show, you can invite comics in other cities to your show.
That's true.
And that's a good way to get yourself in other cities and start building a good little tour roster.
Yes. Yes.
Because ultimately, the only person that's got too many people are waiting for somebody to give them this golden opportunity.
Of course.
You got to create your own opportunity.
Oh, more and more and more and more. And it's funny because when I went to graduate school, because I'm a decade plus older than you, let's say. And when I got out of graduate school, you know, I just got an agent because acting agent. And then I just went on auditions. And then that was okay. And I got some TV. I got some Broadway. And then I wanted to do comedy. And Jamie Masada was kind of like my erstwhile manager in the very beginning. And then he just kind of put me up. And that was it. And I never really did anything else. I never looked for agents or managers or anything. I just kind of did that. And I squeaked along doing what I do. But particularly now, you look at what's going on. As much as people like to shit on like the younger generation, man, they are so many people are making a living off of YouTube and Facebook and Instagram. It's fucking insane. So me, I'm just like, God damn, I don't know how the fuck I do. Because nowadays, I don't know how the fuck you would get an agent. So I tell people, if you want to get an agent, create your own content. Make your own film with your fucking iPhone. That's how you get an agent. Because now it's not like you just walk. people think they drive up to LA looking good. They get off their bus from Wichita, and the guys are like, "You, I'm going to make you a star, kid." And that does happen, but it's usually just men who want to fuck a hot young woman.
Yeah, usually that means it's a sexual assault waiting to happen.
Yeah, yeah, or it's like the Barry Katz semi Me Too situation where he just looks like a fucking drowned mouse. And he brings women and goes, "Let me, I'm going to make you, I want to help you out." And then he puts him in the corner table katana and talks about the view from his mansion in Santa Monica. Shout out to Barry Katz. Anyway, so.
Yeah, the story is old as Hollywood, which is.
Yeah, but you know, it's not a, but that's one of those things where like, okay, he's not being aggressive. He's not being forceful. He's just dangling the carrot in a very obvious way.
She's
like,
got hopes and dreams.
I got a lot of influence in this town. I look like I'm dying of leprosy, but still. So, I hope he hears this. Honestly. Okay, so you came out for Playboy. Did you just start working immediately with Playboy and you were doing that for years?
Did the Playboy thing.
But you were still doing comedy at the time.
I was still in college, dude.
Still in college.
I was still in college.
How do you still do college?
So I was in college. There's a party that happened during the summer, and then what ended up happening was I got hired by Playboy in New York to do like their college marketing stuff. So like the Playboy tanning stickers, the suntan lotion, and a Sarah Silverman comedy special that they did with Playboy. All the Playboy brand integrations, and I wrote like dating tips for guys and like the magazine, and then like did a variety of things.
So this is
2007, 2008.
And so Playboy is still a really big publication then, right?
Still huge.
Still huge, yeah.
Still huge. Girls Next Door is on TV. Girls idolized like the three girls that were dating Hugh Hefner at that point in time.
Oh, yeah, so that's true.
It was still cool to be associated with
It was still
Playboy.
Cool to be. Yeah, when did that end?
I'd say probably 2011, 2012.
Yeah, what was the turning point? Was it just sort of like a new wave of feminism, or was it like... I mean, it's really weird because if you look at Hugh Hefner's legacy, depending on who you listen to or what documentary you watch, he was either this amazing, racially diverse person who championed minorities and tried to help women be their best, or he was an evil pig fucking monster. And I don't know what the truth is. What do you think? You must have met him, obviously.
I think the shades of gray. You know, I think it depends on your personal experience with him.
Yeah.
I think from a minority perspective, he put on a lot of people that were ethnically different to a lot of different opportunities on TV.
Yeah,
and he
sure.
dealt with a lot of backlash for that. So in that way, he was a big civil rights advocate.
100%. Because wasn't one of the for his TV show, he put Sammy Davis Jr. on, and I remember they were like, "You can't have Sammy Davis," and he was like, "Well, fuck you, I'm doing it." And he did it anyway.
Did it anyway.
And I think that's fucking badass. I love hearing shit like that. But then him and his fucking multiple wives who are like, "Ugh, I can't believe I had to fuck this guy for all these years," is bananas. I also hate the women that were with Hugh Hefner, and now that he's dead, they're out there shitting on him on the internet. Have you seen these women?
I've seen it.
It's just like, what do you now? Now, you weren't 20 at the time. You were 32. You were an adult person. And you decided to do this for years. And you made a lot of money and a lot of connections and a lot of opportunities. And now he's dead. You're like, "Oh, yeah, that fucking asshole. That scumbag." Nah.
And the weird thing about it, part of it, like there's some things that are definitely just clearly wrong. But part of it is, would you have been able to have that mark or be the person you are in society or have that notoriety or fame that you live off of now if you didn't have that experience? Because sometimes the bad things that happen to us are what make us fucking great or better, you know? The fucked up shit in our lives, especially as comics, is what makes us fucking funny.
Yeah. Although we were talking about last night, we were talking about Brian Dunkelman.
Yeah.
Who killed. He was a very funny guy. I hadn't seen him in a long time. He was very funny last night. So, you know, I'm not saying don't watch his comedy, watch his comedy. But the only thing I'd heard about Brian Dunkelman was he was the first co-host of American Idol with Ryan Seacrest, and he was like supposed to be the big star, the big breakout star. And when season two came along, because you know, you basically just sign up for the pilot and you have like a 1-year contract, I don't know what the fuck it was, and then he just kind of was like, "Nah, I need more than Ryan, I need more than what you're offering." He basically, like, they fired him because he didn't, whatever the situation was, he didn't come back for season two. And then American Idol became American Idol, and Ryan Seacrest became one of the richest human beings in the fucking world.
Ridiculously wealthy.
So Brian Dunkelman's out there doing hotel lobby bar shows, and you can. And there's a certain point, like we all have feelings like, I could have, if I'd gotten this, but that's a tough one. That's a tough one to swallow.
It's a brutal one to swallow.
Like I have things like I was pinned for Oppenheimer, and I was between me and another person for a small role, and I'm like, but that's very different than being on American Idol and through your own fucking decisions, you are no longer on it.
Hindsight is always 20/20.
Yes, 100%.
We've all walked away from something at some point.
Yeah, I think it's so hard to look at any situation and go, okay, how much of this is just my ego? And how much of this is actually what's best for me in my career? I think it's a very hard decision. I want to go back to Playboy. So
yeah.
You're working there. You're at the mansion a lot.
I did like, I think 5 parties at the Playboy Mansion, and then
so you threw the parties.
Yeah, I helped with the.
That must have been nerve wracking the first time you had to throw a party at the Playboy Mansion, the most famous.
Max did the majority of the throwing. Yeah. I did like some invites.
But so you were Max's like assistant and shit.
I was like an independent promoter. Everyone's kind of like an independent promoter, and that's
making a good living at this point doing this.
Not doing that. I made better with like the traditional stuff, and then the private parties that I hosted, because when I went to other cities to promote the party, I would post a party at a nightclub or a venue, and I'd sell tickets to that and make money off of that and do a booking. And I'd book like some sort of rapper or artist and like make it into an experience. So like you find a creative way to make a hustle out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's really interesting. So do you have any stories that you'd be willing to share from the Playboy Mansion?
Playboy Mansion? What was interesting about that?
I mean, there must have been, you must have seen some shit or heard some shit. You don't have to use names, but could you?
Could I?
There must be something that you're like, oh, I saw blah, blah, blah doing blue, blue, blue with blah, blah, blee, blue, blue.
Actually, I had a great interaction with Tommy Lee, which was fucking kind of just humorous. And I think about this to this day, and this is my standard of what I think fame is.
Yeah.
I met Tommy that first time at the Playboy Mansion, and obviously I was a 19-year-old kid, so I looked young.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, as far as Max knew, I was a 21-year-old kid from Ghana because I had a fake Ghanaian passport. That's what I used.
You had a fake Indian passport?
I had a fake passport from Africa.
Oh, my God. That's pretty fucking amazing.
Yeah, that was a great, like, fake ID that I had.
God, I want to get a fake passport.
That was just super fucking funny, dude. I remember I was a kid, and I was like, that's how I got into bars, this Ghanaian passport.
How realistic was this passport?
It looked like a real passport, man.
Damn. Give me your connection. Anyway, so...
I had a kid. So, basically, I was there, and I was grabbing a drink. He's like, hey, kid, you famous? I moved out here when I was probably, like, about your age. And he's like, I was a rock star. I have no idea who Tommy Lee is at this point in my life. Because like, I grew up in an urban environment. I know rappers. I don't know rock stars.
Yeah.
So he has this band, Motley Crue. He's like, you want to know when you've really made it in Hollywood? It's when your agent sets you up on a date with a girl and she blows you on the way to drinks. And then he walks away.
That's
he
what
walks
he
away. He just walks away. There's no like rebuttal time. There's not really much of like a conversation. It's a very one-sided conversation. He was definitely like fucked
an
up.
Agent sets you up with a girl, and she blows you on the way to drinks.
Yeah, she blows you on the drinks. On the way to drinks.
Wow, that's thank you. That's making it, huh?
That's making it. You know.
Interesting.
I don't think agents like that exist anymore. They pick a girl. You pick a girl. No, you pick a girl out of a magazine. You pick a girl out of a magazine, your agent sets you up for a drinks date, and you fuck her before drinks.
You don't think that oh, bro, it happens.
I need that agent.
But do you realize how fucking scummy some of these agents and managers are?
Oh, definitely.
I mean, I'm talking about, like, they make Epstein look like fucking Mr. Rogers, dude. Some of the shit these agents are doing, I'll tell you what they're doing. I don't fucking drop names. I don't fucking care. So there are certain people... certain actresses, they may be people like Paris Hilton, they may be people like Megan Fox, maybe people like a Saudi prince or some fucking billionaire in some country is basically like, I want to fuck your client. And they're like, it's a PA, public appearance. They fly him out to fucking wherever the goddamn Oman, wherever the country is. And they... get paid like, I mean, I don't know, $500,000, $1 million, whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah.
And they go, and basically, but the understanding is that they fuck the fucking prince or the sheik or the fucking whoever it is. And that's
Habiti, come to Dubai.
And and they do. And a lot of these types, these alleged types, like similar to Paris Hilton and Megan Fox and people like that, they do it. And they make lots of money. And it's all in the fucking DL. And agents, managers have been doing that for fucking decades in this fucking town. To this day, they're like, have fun in Dubai. To some like semi, not A-list, but B-list actresses.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe actors too, who are like, you know, maybe someone wants a little man ass. I don't know.
Anything for 10 to 15%, right?
Yeah. And if people think that is not true, if people think that I'm wrong, they are living under a fucking rock. This fucking town, anything that you've imagined happened in this town has happened in this town. I'm not saying that the majority of people are doing it. Obviously not. I think the majority of people are just, they're nice people. But there's a good like 1% of 1% of people that are doing some of the fucking gnarliest shit. Like the pedophiles and the kid fucking. I mean, it's out there, dude.
I heard some wild shit. I went to Tom Sizemore. I went to his wake. And he dated Heidi Fleiss, the Hollywood Madam.
Yes.
The speeches at Tom Sizemore's fucking like wake were literally like a Comedy Central roast. Some of the wildest stories you could ever fucking imagine.
I wish you were like secretly recording that shit.
It was the wildest thing I've ever been invited to.
What were they saying?
Dude, just wild shit. They're like, you know, there's this time that Tom showed up and he was with Heidi and probably a couple of escorts and some cocaine and... He wasn't like a regular dad. He was more like
this is his child.
One of his kids, yeah, man.
Oh my god,
that is wild, dude. His managers would say some wild stories, compare him with Charlie Sheen. I was like, this is epic. I'm like, this is a tell-all story right here.
Yeah, my god, that's wild. So you were working at Playboy. It was going great. When did you stop?
2010. Ended up like graduating from my undergrad at Bentley. Stayed in Boston, got a regular job,
God
9 to 5.
How did you go from Playboy Mansion, L.A., living that life? Because you were getting laid, I'm imagining.
I was having a great time. I met a girl.
In Boston.
She was
out
a nurse.
Out in L.A. with the most beautiful woman, but you met a girl from fucking Boston.
And she was a nurse, man. She was a girl from South Boston.
Very good. Southie fucking nurse.
Southie accent,
fucking,
you know?
Just sweetheart, but probably put it on you in the sack.
You know, probably would fight a girl for me.
Yeah.
And at that period in my life, I thought that was very attractive.
I met a girl from Dorchester one time. I called her Wilhelmina Hunting because she was a genius, but she was a fucking, just this bull-nosed fucking, like, what the fuck, you fucking retard? Why? She was really fucking aggressive.
They're always aggressive, you know?
Yeah. She's not a big producer. Anyway, so you met this girl from Boston. You went back. You had a job. You wore a suit and tie. And what were you doing?
Wore a suit and tie. Actually, by the time I actually quit the job that I had with, like, the digital team in New York, she was cheating on me with somebody when I went on, like, the last set of, like, road shows that I had, like, for spring break
stuff. How did you find out she cheated on you?
My friend told me that she was cheating on me with another guy that I knew that she didn't know that I knew.
Oh my god. I mean, you're sure your friend was right? You found out?
Well, my friend was 100% accurate about that.
What'd you do? How'd you confront it?
I asked the other guy, and he told me. We were friends. I was friends with the other guy. He didn't know that I was with her at that point.
I don't know if I've been cheated on by a woman that I was like in a serious relationship. I probably have. I don't want to know about it. I don't want
to know. Nobody wants to know.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know. The best thing is, I need to know that. I don't need to know the truth. You don't like me? Whatever. I don't care. I gotta go. Bye.
Just lie to me better.
Were you living with this girl? How deep?
No, we weren't living together, but like, it was enough
you
that I wanted to stay.
Moved back for her.
Yeah, I wanted
and
to stay.
And she knew you moved back for her.
Yes.
And she wanted you to move back for her.
Yes, I was.
Who was this guy she was fucking?
Just a random guy, bro. Nothing special.
Oh, fuck.
An accountant.
And he was a buddy of yours or an acquaintance?
It was a buddy of mine. It was an acquaintance of mine.
So what happened, man? How did you confront it? What did you do? At that age.
I just asked him. I was like, hey, is it true that you're actually fucking this chick? And he's like, yeah. It happened during the last snowstorm when we all got snowed in. And I was like, okay, cool. That was the end of it.
And then what'd you do?
I was like, fuck. I was like, fuck, can I get my job back? And my buddy was like, yeah, that
ship has sailed.
That ship has sailed. The hiring wreck that we had available is gone.
You're sitting there with your briefcase and your suit in Boston in the middle of winter. Like,
going to a Bank of America.
I
worked at Bank of America getting yelled at by random people about like random shit that didn't even fucking concern me.
And your girlfriend. And how did you confront your girlfriend? What did you say?
We went out for drinks at a bar. I went to the bathroom.
You kept it that cool that you were able to go out to drinks and be cool and be like, I'd have been like.
I had a plan. I was calculating.
Bitch!
I was calculating, man. We went out for drinks in Southie. The tab was on her card.
Yeah.
We got drunk. I went to a bathroom. There was a back door that was open. I left. That's how we ended the relationship.
Okay, and that's the full integrity that I would have. Okay,
you know, she fucked my friend. I fucked her wallet.
How much did you run up? I hope you run it up.
Probably like $200, bro.
Oh, god damn you, pussy! Should have been like Dom Perignon tonight. Oh wow. And you never talked to her again?
Never talked to her again. She never messaged me about it. I didn't talk to her about it. We left it there.
She knew.
It was an Irish goodbye.
Yeah, tell me about it. The guy must have said like, "Hey, I talked to fucking Ashlyn." He said. He asked me for a fucking. Oh man. Do you ever then, like, go back and? I wonder what she's up to and look on Instagram. Or you ever do that with exes?
Dude, I haven't looked. I honestly haven't looked.
It's good. It's good. It's good.
It's healthy not to look.
Oh, don't
look. Once you look, you start wondering. Because like if I listen to a Drake on a long road trip driving out to a comedy show somewhere in Riverside County, I'll wonder if like I shouldn't have played tag with my boys in second grade and made it work with Stacy and played house. Would I be playing house in real life right now with her?
Yeah.
You know, would we have 2.5 kids, a dog, white picket fence, and a mortgage I can't pay?
Well, one thing I'll say about that is the answer is no. Because either you're drawn to that life or you're not. It's not a. That is a question of like, did I make the right choice? The truth is, we go into that life kicking and screaming. We really do. As artists and particularly as creatives and as comics, that is not a life that we go, oh, give me some of that. Give me some of that picket fence action.
Well, we don't want stability.
I mean, I think there's a point. Like, I'm at the point where I'm like, ah, fuck. I think I gotta marry someone and just. Can't be a fucking complete asshole. But it doesn't feel the same way it used to feel when I think about marriage of like, ugh. Now I'm like, man, I'm half my life is over now.
Yeah.
So I just got to fucking slide down the back half and have some chick who's willing to wipe my ass when I'm 80.
I mean,
you
dude.
You change. It's like you're going up a roller coaster and then you just start going over the crest and you're going down and you're like, oh shit, this is the fucking drop. But this is like, oh, potential. And now I'm just kind of like, man, I just got to fucking manage the fucking drop.
Yeah, no, like for me, the Indian in me just takes whatever work I can get. I got an audition today. It's like, guy making quizzical faces looking at iPad for a tech company. Yeah. And I'm like, this is obviously an Apple one. And they're like, it's an Apple logo. And I'm like, it's Apple. I believe it's an Apple ad. And I'm like, that has a good residual payout. I'm going to fucking go for that.
Course,
you know?
Of course, my God.
Too many people have artistic integrity. Like, I only want to be funny. I'm like, fuck that.
I feel like artistic integrity has gone the way of the dodo bird. Because once Snoop Dogg started fucking selling out in every possible way, and Ice Cube, Ice-T, all the fucking legit hardcore rappers started just fucking like shilling for corporate bullshit. I felt like selling out became a thing of the past.
I did an audition for a Snoop Dogg, Kevin Hart, like, comic-based reality show thing that they were doing. And then they found out I had, like, a couple 100,000 followers on Instagram. And they're like, hey, there are these 7 different products that want to film, like, ads with you on. So they got the ad content and posted it, so I obviously shared it. Mm-hmm. Show never came to reality. I was like, damn.
Oh, no? Oh, that's too bad. Yeah.
But I was a whore for the products. I was like, you know, whatever you want. Death Row vapes. We got you. Death Row blunts. Let's do it. Death Row phone chargers.
I love that. So after you were in Boston, cheated girlfriend, left at the bar, couldn't get your job back. That's a Heart of Darkness moment. In the movie, that's a Heart of Darkness moment, right? That's where you're like, where the fuck do I go?
Pulling into a Bank of America, getting yelled at about like a quarter of a penny in interest not showing up in somebody's account.
Yeah.
For hours of your life, 6 days a week.
And you'd gone through the breakup and you're still working Bank of America, just miserable. What was your plan? What did you do?
So I was like, I want to move out to California. I want to be in entertainment. I wanted to be Carson Daly originally, and they're like, there's no way you're going to hit the hot white girl demographic, but like, I had the job with Playboy before in the past. So I was like, I feel like this is a demographic I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
I speak to these people, you know? So ultimately, I ended up coming out to California. I had a friend that had a friend that was a big VIP host in Vegas. I was like, cool, I'll work in Vegas. He has a lot of these big celebrity clientele. I'll be fucking funny and charismatic, and then somebody will hire me and give me an opportunity. Did that in Vegas, came back to Boston, had another friend that was working in casting on some Adam Sandler movies, That's My Boy, I Hate You, Dad. And he's like, hey, there are these roles that I'm trying to cast, like hot girl roles. Some of them are semi-nude. I feel like you might have a knack for this. And I was like, dude, like, get me on. Like, put me on, like, something as a background or whatever. You know, just get me on the movie in some capacity. Yeah. I will fucking handle this.
Yeah.
So I started being the guy that casted all these roles.
Oh.
Leveraged what I did with, like, Max back in the day with these Playboy parties that were, like, ticketed.
Yeah.
And I hit up all these clubs and I'd host these events and cast girls for these movies. And I was like, I'm getting a check from my buddy. I'm making a little bit of money doing this sort of thing. But I'm also, like, getting access, what I thought, to, like, movies. And then I realized, I'm literally just booking hot girl roles. There's no real advancement for me in this shit other
it's
than
not very
like
vertical.
I have a lot of pretty girls sending me photos.
Yeah.
And wild things and like, you know, dirty text messages hitting on me and trying to get a role.
And that feels good when you're in your 20s.
It feels great as a man, but I'm like, I'm smarter than this.
Yeah.
She doesn't like me. She wants to be a movie star.
Of course.
You know, I'm not going to fall for this this bait. So I started repping some of these girls. I got them into traditional magazines like FHM, Maxim. Mm-hmm. Started managing these girls. Ended up like realizing I wanted to do entertainment. Had a little book of business, but like on screen might not work out for me.
Yeah.
So got a friend to help me get an interview with the talent agency, Paradigm. Went in for an interview.
Which is a very big agency.
Very big agency. The person didn't want to meet at the office. They're like, let's meet at a coffee shop. I'm like, this is a little bit weird. Met with me for coffee. Weirdest fucking 20-minute interview of my life. Flew back to Boston. Had a class. I was getting a master's degree to get out of paying my student loan. So I got into more debt to avoid paying like a student loan. George Hinojosa, who managed Ice-T and Madonna, lectured that class. And then he asked how do movies make money. And I said something about foreign sales. He thought I was smart. He connected me with Chris Smith, who is a prolific comedy agent. He represented everybody from Cat Williams.
Yeah, yeah.
Had an interview with Chris Smith, which was, again, very odd in its just personality. It was like, tell me about yourself. Fuck it. What would you do if you had to babysit some of my clients and they were doing coke? And I was like, well, how much coke are they doing? He's like, yeah. It doesn't really matter. And I'm like, well, I'm going to let them do what they want, and then I'm going to lure them out of their cocaine hole once they run out of their cocaine to show up to set.
Yeah, yeah.
With the promise that they might get more cocaine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He got him laughing. He's like, this was just a fucking funny bullshit conversation. I'll get you in. So got a gig over there, realized that social media was like the next iteration, in my opinion, of like what TV was. Mm-hmm. So like, it's not where are you watching? Are you watching a movie? Are you watching a TV show? It's what size screen are you watching content on?
Mm-hmm.
Had a friend that was leaving Disney, started a management company, represented Terrell Owens, the NFL player, Gabby Hanna, some of these digital stars. Started doing their management deals, started getting their money up to like pretty good money. I got one of the girls that did body art, Jody Steele, $50,000 to do a video on Facebook.
Wow.
So I was doing that sort of shit. Got hired by a different company because they knew I knew a lot of these rappers to run their social media. Ran a lot of like big celebrities' Facebook pages, running a share-for-share network. Ended up producing parties for like Justin Combs, Bumble, a lot of these people. So I was around all these rappers. They thought I was funny. I was around pretty girls, which was always my conduit. You know, I was like the what's it called? The streetcar called Desire. That was my life, but in reverse. I was like, I live my life off the generosity of beautiful women.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I realized that being with them would be more traumatic and danger than the fruit it would bear.
But being their mediator.
Being their friend.
And friend.
Put me in rooms because the guy that wants to sleep with her, either I'm his friend or I'm his competition.
Yeah.
So that got me in a lot of rooms. And then that ultimately led to me kind of transitioning towards comedy because people would book me because a lot of comedians would like to see some pretty girls come to their shows.
Of course, yeah.
And then what I started doing, which was super funny, was I'd look at who the biggest comics were, if they followed any of the girls I knew, and then I'd have that girl come to the show, and I'd have a bit in like the first year I did comedy where I'm like, my girlfriend just broke out with me, I'm gonna leave with like a girl that's like a cheerleader, a model, an Insta girl, whatever it was, that I'd leave with that girl. Wouldn't try and talk to the comic that I wanted to befriend at that period of age because like I was just a new guy that I've never seen, whatever. But then after a while, people would be like, I want to be his friend because he knows the girl I want to meet.
Yeah, yeah.
And I literally was just her friend. I'm like, oh, I can make that introduction. You want to meet her? Go ahead.
Oh, wow. So like a little bit of a comedy pimp.
Not so a comedy pimp.
I was a
matchmaker.
Matchmaker. Oh, I like that. Did you find any comics, like headliners that you attached to, they're like, hey, and you worked with them and then you facilitated getting hot girls to their shows or anything like that?
Honestly, it never really worked that well.
Yeah.
It worked that people found it to be like an interesting niche, but it never really like transitioned because a lot of times the girl didn't want to get with who that guy was.
Yeah.
And I was just a friend. There was no money opportunity in this thing for me. It was like set time.
Yeah.
So I was like, hey, talk to this guy. You like him, you like him. If you don't, whatever.
I think there used to be a time in the comedy world. I'm sure it still exists, but I've aged out of that world. And also there's been, obviously, as we know, a reckoning about it. But where the feature was really just the wingman. The feature wasn't really the strongest comic or the person who made the show the best. The feature was a guy who was willing to carry the bags and talk to every fucking woman out there to see if they want to fuck the headliner. That honestly, truly. And I've worked with enough headliners where I've never had that job explicitly, But there was definitely, I've definitely had to be a wingman a lot. It was never like, okay, now you got to go down to the casino floor and talk to all the girls, hand them cards, tell them here. I mean, I've heard stories fucking make your hair curl. Yeah. But
that'd be a miserable life too, doing that, dude.
But some people, but it's like the people who work for the mafia. They just want to be a henchman. They want to be the Capone. They don't want to be the, you know, is that the Capone? What's it called? The Captain? I don't know. What the fuck? What's
the
second?
The Kappa. Kappa to the Kappa.
But they don't. Yeah, they don't want to be. They want to be the second. They want to be, and I'm okay with that. But yeah, when it came to like getting girls or picking up, I'm just like,
feels creepy.
Nah, not for me, man. You know.
I'll just get funnier eventually.
Yeah, but then you are in situations where you're on a weekend with someone and they're like, hey, man, and you realize, oh, they want me to help them talk to this cookie monster while he's talking to the hot girl, so keep her occupied so that he can go off and do his thing. I mean, it was just became such a part of the gig, you know?
I mean, most of us just want attention. We don't really care if it goes anywhere. We just want people to like us. Why else would we get in front of stages and try and make people laugh in a wine bar in Beverly Hills?
So have you been on the road at all as a comic?
A little bit. I've done Vegas. I've done a couple of Boston shows. I did a couple Texas shows. Trying to get out there more on the road.
As a headliner, are you as a feature, or what do you do?
Dude, just random shit. I've finagled my way into getting booked. I'd follow a club online, message them.
Got it. Yeah, that's smart. Yeah. And how many years have you been doing comedy at this point?
4 years now.
4 years?
4 years.
Oh, Jesus. You started like right before the pandemic or something?
Literally, dude. Right as like the pandemic got started, it was right around the same time I got started.
My first show was a Zoom show.
Dude, it was the parking lot shows. Do you remember the ones that people would do in cars? They'd flash their lights or honk their horns?
Oh, I know. I know Matt Rife had one.
They were fucking horrible.
The back of the pickup truck. And then there was... Oh, and then they'd have ones at the drive-in movie theaters, which I never did, which I'm glad. I did virtual and I did Zoom, and that's just the way you're just with a bunch of comics, you're working on jokes.
So you work on your material.
So you don't completely atrophy, you know?
Yeah.
But that's a bizarre time to start.
Very weird time to start.
When was your first live show in a club with people?
First show in a club was probably towards the end of 2020.
Okay.
At the Roosevelt in the theater.
Oh, Jimmy Shin show.
No, not a Jimmy Shin show.
Oh, it was Max
originally
show.
Max's shows.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Max was doing those shows.
Oh, and then Max isn't doing those shows anymore.
He doesn't do the Roosevelt anymore.
For reasons that we can't disclose.
Yeah, for reasons we cannot disclose. Comedy is a dog-eat-dog world, you know? It's like turf is once yours, it might not be yours tomorrow.
It's crazy, man. I can't believe how... Like you said, it's one of those professions where we really should be helping each other out because we are... We are. I think we all have to accept that we are the lowest fucking rung on the totem pole. Comedy star, and then it's like TV star, movie star. But is it comedy star, daytime TV star, reality star? There's so many levels above fucking comedy star.
The cavemen had comedy stars. Yeah. There was a caveman back in the day by a fire cracking jokes.
Yeah, exactly.
Mostly probably physical humor, because who knows how much language
and
was
even Dave Chappelle, like in the day, like of course he's considered the GOAT and blah blah blah, but what made Dave Chappelle famous was TV and film. What made Chris Rock famous was TV and film. What made Louis C.K. famous was TV and film, you know? At the end of the day, like, it doesn't matter.
It's also what makes you a better headliner or a draw for any other club, and that's what can get you booked, you know? Yeah. You got to diversify your experience to book some of those roles.
And you also produce films, is that right?
I've produced a full-length feature film called Habitual. We had a theatrical release. We had a theatrical release. We won like 7 awards at the festivals.
Nice.
Got a positive review from Burr. Wasn't a comedy. It was a horror film. But, you know, sometimes people like that. It's called Habitual.
Habitual.
I made it with my good friend Johnny Hickey, a reformed Boston gangster.
Oh, I like that.
His generation before him robbed banks. Our generation robbed pharmacies.
Oh, wow. I like that. I have a friend who's producing a Boston crime film right now. Maybe I should connect you guys.
Oh, definitely, dude.
Because she's looking for people. And you know how it is in the independent film world. It's like same thing with comedy. Like a lot of these actors are like, look, dude, here's where you are in your career. Okay? Do the show for $50,000. Well, my quote is shut up.
Fucking take it. Shut up.
But you know, blah 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 makes shut up. I made da 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 shut up. I fucking hate it. Like Jeremy Piven, like, you know, guys, $100,000 a quote for a week. And I'm like, that's great. He'll get it sometimes. But also, like, what do you want to do? Do you want to work? Or do you want to, like, just feel justified by your quote? I don't know. I'm just not that guy.
I mean, dude, for me, it's like, how do I get up at every club or every venue and like try and deliver a great set? How do I work through more material?
Yeah.
How do I become more regular at these venues and deepen those relationships? Because it's not just about that gig you're getting today. Mm-hmm. It's about what that gig leads to in terms of your experience, but also the random people that end up at shows in LA at the three big clubs in LA.
Yeah.
Those are producers, those are agents, those are managers, those are people that have a show.
Yeah.
And if they just like you, you might book.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it hasn't happened for me yet. No, the truth is, when I do shows at Improv,
mm-hmm,
or Comedy Store, I almost always get some sort of weird connection with someone who's like, I'm doing this, or I'm doing that, or I'm, you know.
90% of the time, it doesn't happen.
Laugh Factory, not so much. I don't know why. It doesn't really. But yeah, it can always, weird things can happen all the time. But I feel like every time someone's like really, really into me, and I'm always like, what do you do? It's like, well, I clean dogs and fucking Encino. I'm like, oh, God damn it. Can you be a studio producer at one point?
It's wild. I've gotten a guy to buy a house. I got my real estate license during quarantine. I have a bit about being a real estate agent. And I prospect everyone in the audience to see if they're buying or selling a house.
So you're still doing it?
Yeah, dude.
That's a great gig, right? Because you have the license. You can do it on your own time.
I do it on my own time. It gives me my nights free for the comedy stuff.
And you can still, and you've been selling places or leasing?
I sold a house to a doctor in the Hollywood Hills. It was used as a recording studio house. A lot of rappers have recorded out there. Everybody from like Diddy to Drake to Young Thug.
Yeah.
So sold that house in the Hollywood Hills. Got another one.
Recently?
Yeah.
Wow.
$2.75 million on that one. And then I got a $5 million buyer in Malibu right now. We looked at Evan Spiegel and Miranda Kerr's old house.
Oh, nice.
Which is pretty cool.
So you rich, motherfucker, huh? You
know, bro. I'm fucking a guy that I was in a Toyota Camry up until last week. 2012 Toyota Camry that I drove out to California in. I just fucking try, bro. That's my fucking life. I will try, but also like, the truth is, it's all about reciprocity. If you bring in people when you're newer to something, if you bring in other people on your deal and you make less money, for me, that's a fucking better goal because then I'm preserving how I'm doing things. I'm moving in the right way because you don't know the shit that you don't know.
Of course.
And a lot of people fucking fuck that shit up.
Of course.
Like running a light at certain clubs, some people will fucking go ape shit on you for running a light.
Yes.
And I watched some new comics do that for minutes on end.
Then
like they're like, why doesn't that place book me again? I'm like, because you fucking offended the guy. It can happen. It happens to everybody at some point. You miss it, you just don't catch it, whatever. You're on a streak. Apologize to the sound guy. Just be a fucking human. At the end of the day, we all got to treat each other like a human because it's a coworker that you're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so do you like producing comedy shows?
I like performing more than I like producing. It's much more stressful producing. Because you just deal with so much ego from everyone. Not just comics, but like guests of a comic, random like, you know,
I know
anything.
Dane Cook. Can you get me and my 18 friends in for free?
Dude, 2 weeks ago, I had a guy came up to a show and it was in the same wine bar. And it was the first one. I've never like fucking ran a door other than like for like a rapper party. Like when I do that, it's basically just telling everybody to fuck off. Unless you're an attractive person or you're famous, you can get in, you're good.
Yeah, of course.
But in this scenario, it's like, oh, do you have a ticket? No, but I'm on the list. You're not on the list. Okay, this person put me on the list, can you get them? And I'm like, can you call them? Because I don't even have this person's phone number. They're like, well, how much is a ticket? $25. That's the most expensive thing in Beverly Hills.
At which point
I had to tell him, you know, did you park valet here? And he's like, I did. Why are you asking? I'm like, well, it's $62 to park. Thought the guy was about to have a heart attack. And if he had a heart attack, ambulances normally cost in Los Angeles about $1,000. In Beverly Hills, it's $1,800 to $2,500.
Holy shit.
I wouldn't want to be my cousin that works at Cedar Sinai trying to argue with him about that bill. It's not going to go over too well.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's amazing. So what do you have lined up? What are the big goals for you? You seem like you're definitely someone who is making things happen, and I really admire your hustle, man. And I think I didn't get to see your act last night, but I'm sure it's very funny.
It's fun.
It's very funny, and you have a good time on stage.
I have a blast, bro.
You have a blast, and that's 80% of it, right?
It's having a unique POV, because you can either just do hacky shit, which is just the same relatable shit, or you can share stuff about your story. That took me about like a year and a half into my comedy journey to just lean into like being an Indian guy from Boston with a Boston accent.
Yeah.
That's a fucking fun bit to do. Talking about like my mom, family dynamics, you know? Shit like that is a fucking blast. The more you lean into like the truth of your own personal existence, I think the better you get as a comic.
Absolutely.
And the more you just humble yourself into do I want to do this to be famous or do I want to do this because I love it? Because once you start actually just loving it without a regard to your ego, because like, dude, that was the toughest thing for me was like, I have a following on Instagram. I've booked a couple of movies. I've been in a couple of things. How do I humble myself to want to pull up to an audition night, sit there in the crowd, wait for my name to not get called out of a hat, and then go home and be nice to everybody the next day and do it again next week? Which was my resolution this year, which is like, go to Comedy Store, go to Laugh Factory, go to the Improv, start trying to fucking make friends, figure out how to become more regular on those dockets, and how to book that right movie role. My goal this year is to find a manager or an agent that will work as hard to book me as my Indian mother wants to see me get married. That's some stiff competition with that goal.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a good goal. That's a good goal. Maybe you can do both.
Maybe I can
do both.
So
you got no girl right now?
I'm single, man. I'm dating. I'm ready to mingle. Yeah, I'm an Aries Sun, Leo Moon, Virgo Ascendant.
Yeah, just, you know, I think men should stay singles until single at the very least until they're 40.
You gotta explore.
Because when you're 40, you can still get a nice 28-year-old girl to have your babies.
Yeah.
Why do you want to lock down when you're in your 30s?
Oh, this is the other thing I got going. I got you a gift, my friend.
Oh, is it weed?
No, it's an intention crystal.
Oh.
You know?
I fuck
These
with
ones
that.
Are crystals from India. They're from Haridwar, which is one of the blessed cities out there.
What's it called?
Haridwar.
Hard war,
yeah. It's right by Rishikesh, down by the Himalayan Mountains.
I've been to Rishikesh.
Okay.
I went to Mother Ganga. I did whitewater rafting, and I fell into the river for about 30 minutes, swallowed half of it, and I was like, am I going to die? It was fine.
So, yeah, they're blessed by the river. They're real stones from India. They're like healing crystals. They're the crystal meth that white girls in L.A. like.
Oh, I like it.
Unlike the crystal that the white girls in the desert like.
I'm on my way to looking like Johnny Depp.
Yeah, man.
I got my little bracelet going on.
Rock some crystals.
So what is this gonna make me book jobs?
Peace and protection, man. Peace is the most valuable thing you got in your life.
So you got the healing crystals and the Playboy Mansion and the comedy.
Yep.
And all this producing shit. A lot of disparate elements coming together to make you, Ashwin Jacob. I appreciate it, man. Very cool.
Yeah, man.
Thank you. That's very awesome. Well, listen, man, where can people find you? Let's do some closing thoughts.
My social media is primarily Ashwin Jacob, A-S-H-W-I-N-J-A-C-O-B. I like spelling things out from the spelling bee experiences I had as a child.
Did you really use spelling bee as a child?
No. I just like to say that because I'm Indian. I'm a bad speller. My grammar's not that good. That's how I ended up a comic. If I was better at spelling, I would have been a doctor.
Oh, both my brothers are doctors, and if I was smarter, I would have been
a doctor. Yeah, my other thing that I'm trying to be an influencer on right now in a very true Indian fashion is Venmo and Cash App.
Oh.
Venmo is just Ashwin Jacob, just like my social media. My Cash App is Ashwin J.
Why do you tell people that? Are they just randomly.
Sometimes people send me money. I've done that at stand up sets, yeah.
And they randomly send you money.
Sometimes I've gotten some money off of that.
God damn. That's cool.
Another good tip for people that I'll leave people on this note. This is a value add for people that listen to this podcast.
Yeah.
If you're ever on a dating app and you see a girl saying the best way to reach out to me is on Venmo or Cash App, don't send her that money amount. Write that money amount and put it in as a request to yourself. She'll probably just accept it.
Oh, man. So you're like basically reverse engineering getting money by making these, by counting on these women being stupid.
They're not stupid. They're just trying to.
They're like, oh, request.
I admire their hustle. I admire the hustle and tenacity that they have.
You send them a request.
Yeah.
They think you're sending them money. They accept it.
And then, like, they'll send me a message afterward, which I'll write them a positive affirmation about whatever they've posted, you know? You're a strong, beautiful, confident woman. I know your roommate, Stacy, is being a bitch to you, but you're going to figure it out. They don't want you to solve their problems. They want you to listen. And afterwards, you know, you might actually get the date that you wanted. Whereas if you sent the $20, you're definitely not getting the date.
That's wild. There you go. Life hack. If any of you guys try that and it actually works, I'll pay you $20. I will Venmo you $20 if that works. That's genius. I love that. Anyway, very cool. Very nice to meet you, Ashwin. I'm sure we will keep in touch after this. And people can follow you at your name, A-S-H-W-I-N-Jacob, just the way it sounds.
Just literally the way it sounds.
All right. Thanks you for tuning in, guys. And hopefully, you'll hear from me soon. Bye-bye.